This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. A new state report shows that two virtual charter schools in Indiana inflated their enrollment numbers for years, allowing them to collect tens of millions of taxpayer dollars they weren't entitled to. When the controversy came to light last year, the schools were forced to close. The report from the Indiana State Board of Accounts shows just how much money the schools collected and how they distributed it. If you have questions or comments on our show today, you can let us know on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. You could also leave us a voicemail. Call us at 866-476-3881. Just give us your name, where you're calling from, and a quick question or comment, and we'll do our best to get it into the conversation. Again, that's 866-476-3881. Joining me now is Eric Weddle, education reporter at our flagship station WFYI in Indianapolis. Hi, Eric.
Hello, Matt.
So there's a lot to get into here.
Yeah, it is.
let's just start with the basics. I think a lot of people probably weren't familiar with these schools. So what were Indiana Virtual School and Indiana Virtual Pathways Academy?
Sure. Well, I'll start like basically. So they were both virtual charter schools. And then a virtual school, as one can imagine, is a school that's, you know, pretty much held fully online. So students who attend a virtual school, almost all or all of their coursework is done through a computer. Mm. You know, they're talking to, they're taking courses that are online. They're maybe speaking to someone on the other end of the computer in like a video chat session, watching videos. So that's a virtual school. Both of these schools are virtual charter schools. And then charter school is a non-traditional school that's overseen by its own board. That is kind of responsible for. They govern it. And then to get a charter in Indiana, you have to be authorized by somebody. And so all the charter schools in Indiana are authorized by a number of entities, from school districts to the Indianapolis mayor's office to universities in the state. And so both of these schools were charter schools. Daleville Community School District in Daleville, they are a small district, and they authorized both of these schools. Indiana Virtual School was authorized in 2011 to open up, and Indiana Virtual Pathways Academy was authorized in 2017 to open up.
And are they affiliated with the same, company or group of companies?
Yeah, the same board and oversaw them.
Both different schools?
Yes.
Yeah. So what does this new report from state auditors say that the schools did?
Right. So last year, people may remember back in July, there was a preliminary report that came out and that had, you know, some pretty eye popping numbers in it, some findings saying that the schools were overpaid about more than $40 million through inflating enrollment. This new report that came out, it's 40 plus pages long, mm-hmm. and it really delves into their findings. And what they found was that both schools inflated the enrollment by looking at more than $68 million over 11 years that they received for students who should not have been enrolled. And looking at that data, they found that there were 8,500 students that were improperly enrolled. About half of those never finished a course that they were taking. Wow. They also found that there were 6,000 students who shouldn't have been enrolled because they maybe weren't logging on, or they weren't following the policies that the school was set for itself for to be enrolled at the school.
So where'd the extra money go?
Well, I mean, I think that's, you know, the big question. But I think, you know, just before you jump off that, back to the enrollment issue, I mean, what they found in there was, you know, there were actually students who were enrolled who didn't know they were enrolled. So
how did that happen?
Well, the report details there were students who that they interviewed who maybe emailed the school, said, "Hey, I'm interested,"
and that was counted
logging
as,
in,
as an enrollment.
And then they took their information and enrolled them. Hmm. You know, there were other students. There was a student who had passed away who was kept on the logs for more than a year. Students who had moved out of the state that were kept on there. So that was some of the examples that were given in this report, in addition to just the students who were enrolled, who maybe enrolled purposely, but then never actually completed a course. Yeah. Where'd the money go?
Yeah. Well, how did the state find out about this?
Well, so Daleville Community School Corporation, you know, they started about 2 years ago, thinking something was wrong with this. They were trying to get records from the schools. They were unable to get that. And so they kind of flagged their concerns at that point. Before that, Chalkbeat here in Indiana, they had done an investigation in 2017. And they found out that one of the main companies associated with the school was run by the person who had started the school. And there was some self-paying involved, that the school was paying the company that was the same same people involved. So that's kind of where the report comes in into where the money went. So the past 3 years that the school got more than $100 million in state funding for students enrolled. And they found that 83% of that money was paid to vendors or companies for services that were linked to the virtual school through its employees or board members.
Does it look like, and you can get into specifics mm-hmm. of this and can you really get into the weeds, but does it look like crimes have been committed? I've heard the word fraud tossed out.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, this has been forwarded on, you know, to those authorities to kind of make that, you know, that judgment. But I mean, based on, you know, state law, based on how school money should be used, they're kind of laying this out pretty clearly that thousands and thousands of students that the school received money for, they should not have received money for those students on the enrollment rolls.
Hmm. Can you explain the system that's in place that was exploited here? How did they use the enrollment numbers to get more money? I mean, more students.
Well,
so
in Indiana, I mean, money follows a student is what people like to say. So basically, schools are funded based on the enrollment numbers, and there's an amount of money attached to each student who goes to any school. Traditional public school, magnet school, charter school, virtual charter school. So for each of these students who were listed as enrolled, the state paid an amount for that student. And then also some students received extra funding for maybe special education funding, which are federal dollars. So they received money on that attached to each student.
Hmm. Do we know how long this was going on?
Well, I mean, the report goes back 11 years. You know, in terms of students who shouldn't have been enrolled. And
How can that be? They started in 2011. It's 2020 now. The report.
Oh, I'm sorry. I guess you're right.
It had been going on potentially since.
The report goes back to their first year of opening. And I think it lists a handful of students that were enrolled, that they were paid for, that they should not have been paid for. Mm. But, you know, I think the bulk of that over-enrollment, according to the report, happened in the past few years alone.
Oh, okay. So why?
Thanks for catching me on that.
Well, but why wasn't it caught earlier? It seems like the timeline.
Well, you know, for Daleville schools, you know, they have been very adamant that they were not allowed to look at these enrollment records. You know, that even though they authorized this school to exist, they were not legally allowed to see who was enrolling. You know, there's laws that kind of protect student data. And as an authorizer, they could not go to this school and say, let us see your information. You know, I mean, some people would think, well, if you're authorizing them and your partners, they'd share that. So, you know, that's one issue there.
But there are protections in place that I guess allow these virtual and charter operators to kind of keep that information close to themselves and not really reveal it to the.
Well, I mean, the information was given to the state. You know, I think that gets to the question right now people are asking is like, who is responsible for this? And I think it all depends on who you ask. You know, you ask Daleville, they say, hey, we're the first ones to kind of flag this concern, you know, a few years ago. They then took action and shut the schools down. They revoked the charters last August and did that. You talk to some lawmakers, and some lawmakers blame the other side of the aisle, that they need stronger policies. Some people are saying that the people, and I think House Speaker Bosma, you know, said, you know, this was obviously a criminal activity, and what policy is going to prevent that from happening. Mm. So I think as we go forward through this, I think there's going to be a lot of discussions between the State Board of Education, the Indian Department of Education, and lawmakers and these authorizers, you know, to kind of figure out how did this happen, for one, and how do we let it happen, and, you know, what should have been in place to stop that from happening.
Meanwhile, Senate Bill 431, which we'll talk about later with Senator Mark Stoops, one of the authors, did not get heard in the General Assembly this year. Let's back up. How have leaders from the virtual schools responded to this?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. So back in August, right before Daleville revoked the charters, of these two schools to basically shut them down. I went to the board meeting, that myself and another reporter were at the board meeting for the virtual schools. And before we spoke to them, they basically all said they resigned and that they were basically no longer existent. Mm. Since then, I have not been able to get hold of anyone associated with the schools. I'm not really aware right now of anyone in leadership making any kind of comments based on this report that came out. You know, last year there was a federal subpoena and a grand jury for some of these leaders. So I think, you know, the federal investigators are involved in this. So I'm expecting we're going to hear more, you know, in the coming months.
So it's pretty clear then whose fault this was?
I mean, I think right now in terms of like the over-enrollment, it sounds like based on the subpoena that I've seen is that they're looking at people. They want to get more information from the people who ran and oversaw the schools.
So what has the response been? What will the consequences be? Will there be any
consequences? I think one consequence in terms of like the public and taxpayers is, can we get the money back? You know, I think that's one question. It's going to be interesting to see like how that works. You know, I think that, you know, Daleville may even be asked to give back some of its money since it received, you know, a percentage or a fee for being an authorizer from those schools. So I think that's going to be one big question.
Some people might see this as being the most important question surrounding this. What about the kids who are actually attending these schools?
Yeah, so at the time, so last summer, Daleville was really trying to reach out and ask everyone enrolled to get in touch with them to kind of find a new path or a new school. I believe at that time, a lot of those students were going to be bounced back to their home districts. So based on their address where they would be attending, those schools, I think, were going to be notified of students who were enrolled, who basically were no longer out of a school. But I think that's, you know, probably one of the bigger questions, because I think virtual schools have been seen as, you know, an innovative approach, a new way of doing things has been the hope. I think, and really, there's been a lot of students who need more help have kind of gone to virtual schools looking for an alternative. Mm. So a lot of these students who attend these schools need more assistance. You know, maybe they're behind in their learning. So I think, unfortunately, a lot of these students who need help are probably at a disadvantage now, having the school shut down and whatever happened in terms of the learning there.
Less than a minute to go. Are there other virtual schools in the state where this might have been happening?
I mean, I guess I wouldn't point out virtual schools. I mean, I think this system may show that any school, you know, the enrollment process may be looked at now, or how the state verifies enrollment. Because it seems like if that's a way that they were able to game the system, if it turns out to be true, any other school could as well keep a student on the books who's no longer there if no one's checking on that. So I don't really think we can look at that as just a singular virtual school incident.
Eric Weddle is the education reporter here at our flagship station, WFYI in Indianapolis. Thanks for helping us unpack this complicated education story.
No problem. Thanks.
For the second week in a row, actually. After the break, we're going to bring in a new voice to talk about the history behind this story and find out what groups that support virtual charter schools are saying about it. And we would love to hear your questions and comments. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. We're live next. You can also leave us a voicemail, including your first name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. And we'll try to get that onto the show. We're back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today we're talking about a new state report that shows two Indiana virtual charter schools spent years inappropriately collecting more than $68.7 million in tax dollars by inflating student enrollment numbers. As always, we would love your questions and comments. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, or leave us a voicemail, including your name and where you're calling from, at 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. And we'll try to get to it in this live segment that we have planned for right now. In the studio, we're joined by Betsy Wiley, CEO of the Local Institute for Quality Education. Thanks for coming in, Betsy.
Thanks for having me.
So before we get into it, can you tell us about your group, the Local Institute for Quality Education?
Sure. We're a not-for-profit organization, statewide focus here in Indiana only. And we're interested in advocating for policies, K-12 policies that allow parents and families to have the freedom for their students, their children, to get educated in the best learning environment for them, whatever that may be. Traditional publics, charters, virtuals, magnets, homeschool, private school, whatever that is.
And that's kind of the argument for school choice, which is kind of proliferated here in the state. Give schools the freedom to do what they do, and that will yield the good results that we want to see.
That's certainly the hope, yes.
But when bad actors like this come to the forefront and make the news, as they are right now that we're talking about, it kind of, I guess, what was your reaction when you heard about it?
Well, you're right. I mean, this is a bad actor. So a couple of things. I don't think that we can use a broad brush, as a lot of folks would like to do, and say, oh, this is an alternative model to a traditional public school, so all types of alternative models are bad. I don't think that that's that's fair at all. We've had bad actors, you know, over the years in various traditional public schools that have been, you know, brought up on improprieties and things. And yet we don't say, nor should we say, all, you know, traditional public schools are bad. Having said that, though, I think that it is clear from the reports that State Board of Account has put out and others that they will be putting out, that there are definitely some bad behavior going on here with Indiana Virtual Schools, their authorizer at Daleville Community Schools, perhaps at the DOE here as well. And to that extent, you know, they should be have the book thrown at them. They should be pursued to the fullest extent of the law for misusing taxpayer dollars.
Do you think that the system in place, though, allows for too much of that? Or do you think that what we have now is what we need to retain?
I don't think that the system allows for too much of it, and a couple reasons as to why, right? This is the first time that we've had this issue, and we've had virtual schooling going on for a while. And really, this is an issue about enrollment and enrollment count and how we count our students and how we pay for them. And it's less about school type. And so we don't typically have this. Now, it is raising questions. I think I've had conversations with some lawmakers that say, you know, we need to look at enrollment. I think that there are students that we're paying for that we shouldn't be paying for today in other types of schools as well, not just here at Indiana Virtual or Virtual Pathways Academy.
Do you know anything about what the two schools that we're talking about, Indiana Virtual School and Indiana Virtual Pathways Academy, do you know anything about what they were like before this happened? How did they operate?
I don't know a ton about that. I can tell you that, you know, and the legislature rightly has kind of tightened some stuff up. So both of those schools were authorized by the local school corporation, by Daleville Schools, who quite honestly probably didn't know what they were doing and how difficult of a job being a charter school authorizer is and what those responsibilities are. As evidenced by the fact of if you go and look at their contract, which is publicly available, it's like 15 pages. If you look at Connections Academy, which is sort of the gold standard in virtual charter world across the country, and we have one here operating in Indiana, their contract with their authorizer, Ball State University, is like 250 pages, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, they got into this maybe a bit as a small, struggling school district and looking for a way to make some money and not necessarily doing it for, is this providing the best alternative for kids in terms of an education and making sure that every kid's getting educated to the best of their ability.
And you've said that we should be careful not to paint this with a broad brush, but there are no shortage of people who believe that public school dollars should go to public schools and public schools only. And it's when something like this happens, does it just strengthen their argument or is it hard on you?
Well, I think it shows that they don't fully understand what they're talking about, as charter schools and virtual charter schools are public schools. They are not private schools in any way, shape or form. They do not charge tuition. They are not allowed to have enrollment guidelines. You know, they can't they can't turn away students, I should say, right? They have open enrollment, just like your brick and mortar traditional neighborhood school corporation. And so these are public dollars going to public schools. So those that want to have that argument are just a little bit misinformed from that perspective. Having said that, it's never okay to have taxpayer dollars that are in the public's trust to be misutilized. And to the extent that these were, and it seems pretty evident, at least on first blush here from this first report, that they very well may have been, again, they need to be held accountable for that. And you know, we need to pursue it to the fullest extent of the law.
Why was this able to happen for years without being noticed?
So I think there were a lot of warning signs, and I think that there will be, and I believe the State Board of Accounts will be issuing another report, of course, later this spring, probably post legislative session. So I'm sure it won't get the same kind of attention, but that talks a little bit about that, right? And I do think that there were warning signs. I do have questions about where was Dr. McCormick and the Department of Education when you're seeing enrollment growth at a district of 4,000 new students in a year. When you're getting course completion reports that are saying 4,500 students at this virtual charter school didn't complete a single course, right? These things should be red flags. And these types of reports were being submitted by Indiana Virtual School and Indiana Virtual Pathways Academy. And so I think that there were some very significant red flags. I also want to understand a little bit further, and I was able to listen to Eric Weddle a little bit. I want to understand a little bit further about all the ways in which we sort of had fictitious students. Each student in Indiana is supposed to have a unique identifier that the department is looking at. And so, you know, if I went to Indiana Virtual and said, I'm thinking about enrolling here as a student, and then I change my mind and I stay at my traditional public school, there's a number associated with Betsy Wiley, and it shouldn't be able to be utilized twice. So there are definitely some questions about our system and how we fund.
We're talking to Betsy Wiley, CEO of the Local Institute for Quality Education, about the Indiana Virtual School and Indiana Virtual Virtual Pathways Academy and the alleged fraud that they committed. We have a message on Twitter from Aaron, who writes, I wish people and the news would call it what it is, stealing. Our public schools are in rough shape, and words like freedom were used to hoodwink citizens. No accountability was set up, and this is what we get. There needs to be jail time, and charter schools gotta go. Okay, so that is an argument that we hear, that public school money ought to stay with public schools, and charter schools are siphoning too much of it. And when you look at the amount, $68.7 million, it looks like a lot of money, and it's money that side thinks could have been better used in the traditional school environment.
Yeah, and you know, that's going to be a differing of opinion. A couple of points for Aaron, right? Again, virtual education and virtual charter schools are not the same as traditional charter schools, and charter schools, both virtual and brick and mortar, are public schools. They are 100% public schools. They just have fewer regulations and therefore allow for greater innovation. At least that's, you know, kind of the concept around charter schools than a traditional public school setting allows for. You know, absolutely, I agree, and I think we've kind of said that a couple times. If in fact the allegations are true, and I think that there's already a lot of evidence suggesting that it probably is, then yes, it is stealing. And yes, these people should be held accountable. And yes, you know, they should have the book thrown at them and be, again, pursued to the fullest extent of the law.
We also have a listener voicemail. This is from Ron in Mishawaka, who's concerned that virtual charter schools have negative consequences on public schools. Let's listen.
The whole business of online schools is not so much, doesn't reflect so much dissatisfaction with public schools as it is an attack on public schools. The public schools need the money, and the online schools are generally not getting kids very well educated. We need to acknowledge that, and we need to get the money to public schools, or they can do our entire communities good.
Online schools are not getting kids well educated. Is there evidence behind that argument?
There's evidence to the contrary of that argument. I happened to look at a couple of the other schools, and I mentioned Connections Academy. They run a virtual charter program here in Indiana. And I looked at their data before coming down here. You know, in the areas of English, science, social studies, at the various grade levels in which we test kind of each of those subject matters differently between grades 3 and 10, their students are performing proficiency levels either equal to or slightly better than the state average. And so I do think it's not fair to say that virtual education does not work academically for students. I think it does in many cases. I think families are choosing a virtual education for a variety of reasons, often cited they want to be more involved in their child's education. Their child was bullied in their previous school and needed to be removed from that environment. Their student needs greater flexibility in their school schedule because of other activities or responsibilities. And so, again, it's about finding the best fit. But I don't think that it's fair to say, again, painting with a broad brush, that virtual education is not as academically rigorous or producing as good of academic results as traditional public schooling is here in Indiana.
Are there criticisms, though, or maybe just concerns about the charter system that you think are valid, that and maybe not based on something that you view as a misunderstanding?
I don't, actually. I think there's a lot of misinformation when it comes to charters and virtual charters in the public. And I think that they're being blamed for a lot of challenges that our traditional public school systems are facing. It's important to know that students who go to charter schools or virtual charter schools do not receive any local funding, right? So in Indiana, that's about $3,200 per student per year in local property taxes, and those students do not get that, and those schools do not get that. And so they're doing the same amount of work for quite a bit less money. And I think doing a very good job of that in most instances. Are there charter schools, or in this case, a virtual charter program that isn't doing well and should not be operating? And thankfully now these schools are no longer operating. Absolutely. But I think we have that in every school type of model we have in Indiana, be it charter, traditional, public, private, what have you.
We have another listener voicemail. This one's from George in Noblesville, asking about the consequences for those two, those who were behind this. Let's listen to George.
Yeah, this is George in Noblesville. I wonder what is going on as far as any kind of prosecution on this. I mean, people go and rob banks for lots less money than that, and they get prosecuted. Why aren't they looking into this, and why isn't the legislature looking into this, too? Thanks a lot. Bye.
Well, the legislature is looking into this. Senate Bill 431, addressed by Senator Mark Stoops, who we're going to talk to in the next segment. And really, the news that came about was part of a process, right? The news broke in August that this might be happening. We now know to what extent. And so my guess is that might be down the road.
I think that that's right. When you look at, you know, nothing to this magnitude, but when you look at examples of this that have occurred in other school districts in Indiana over the years, prosecution usually comes into play. And we're talking about significantly less money than we're talking about in this instance. Prosecution usually comes into play, but it is several months down the road before that happens. I think you're right, and I think that we will see that here as well, and I think we should. And obviously, the legislature is looking at it, being cognizant, right, not to, paint everyone with that broad brush.
But that bill that I mentioned, Senate Bill 431, is not being heard by the legislature. Do you think that changes in oversight do need to happen, though?
I don't. I think the problem was, and I think Senate Bill, I think it was 567 last year, was a great reaction by the legislature to address a lot of the issues with Daleville. And that bill was passed because of a lot of the school, issues that were going on with Indiana Virtual and Daleville as an authorizer. That bill prohibits any school district in the state of Indiana from authorizing a virtual charter school anymore, because we learned that Daleville as a district did not have the expertise to be a charter authorizer. It also prohibits any district that authorizes a charter school of any type can no longer accept a charter authorizer fee. So there is no financial incentive for a district to be an authorizer anymore. And so I think very prudently, the Senate and the legislature acted last year by passing Senate Bill 567.
Michael on Facebook writes, "I'm incensed by this $68 million fraud that the GOP has allowed," again, this is Michael writing, "to be perpetrated on the citizens of our state. Someone knew this fraud was taking place, the school's directors, the school board, and whoever was tasked with oversight on this institution. If the state isn't going to audit private schools, they should get no state money." What do you think about Michael's response?
Well, again, I think Michael's got some great points in there, but also some facts wrong. This isn't a private school, and private schools actually do have audits done. This is a charter school who also has audits done. They are supposed to have outside third-party companies, auditing companies, perform their audits, and those audits can be found online. They're publicly online. I agree. that school board members, the charter authorizer themselves, Daleville School Corporation, the Department of Education, as we talked about earlier, there were warning signs and oversight all the way along that I think should have raised eyebrows and caused people to investigate further. I think we're learning in some of these reports that some of the school board members may have been, you know, sort of affiliated or involved in this. So I'm not sure that they're going to be the best oversight of that. But the authorizer and the department certainly should be.
Betsy Wiley is the CEO of the Local Institute for Quality Education. I want to thank you so much for your taking the time today, Betsy.
Thank you for having me.
Up next, we'll share a conversation I had earlier today with Indiana State Senator Mark Stoops about the role legislation could have in addressing this. Because it is a pre-recorded conversation, we won't be able to take your questions or comments on social media or voicemail, but we do hope that you hear what Senator Stoops has to say. I'm Matt Pelser, and we'll be back with that in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Back now to our discussion on a state report that shows two virtual charter schools in Indiana spent years inappropriately collecting $68.7 million in tax dollars by exaggerating enrollment numbers. We're joined now by Indiana State Senator Mark Stoops. Senator, thanks for coming in.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
So we've talked in the show today about a lot of the details around this story. But I'm curious, what did you think when you first heard about it?
I was not surprised. It was more of a duh moment. Mm. We've known that there have been problems with especially the virtual charter schools for a number of years now.
Now, are you lumping all virtual charter schools or just these two, Indiana Virtual School and Indiana Virtual Pathways Academy?
Well, I think there's such a lack of oversight that I would say the concerns are across the board. I haven't heard of any other issues with the other virtual charter schools. There's another three that are operating in Indiana. But at the same time, there is no real process to dig into their books and find out exactly how they're processing, what, you know, how they're allocating their students within those schools, how we are being billed for them. There's a number of other issues, too, and I think many people think of charter schools as not-for-profits. But what's happened is it's such big business. For instance, just over the last, 8, 9 years, Indiana, or actually over the last 5 years, Indiana spent $1.4 billion on charter schools. And you have to imagine this is $1.4 billion that used to go to public schools. So it's big business, and there are a lot of private companies interested in getting those dollars. So what they'll typically do is they'll set up a not-for-profit, and then that not-for-profit hires businesses associated with that entrepreneur to get the services to run the property. So in the case of Indiana Virtual Schools, all of their aligned businesses, which were all owned by, you know, the person responsible or relatives or friends, $83 million out of $100 million was siphoned off to these companies. So that's public funds dropping into a not-for-profit virtual school, then basically just getting siphoned directly out to private banks.
Mm. The argument, of course, versus for not-for-profit versus for-profit is just that it's just one model versus another. Do you see for-profit more problematic than not-for-profit, or can dubious things happen on both sides?
Dubious things can happen on both sides. And first, I want to say that there are many charter schools that that operate in the public interest. They are authorized by public universities, say, for instance, Ball State as an example, and there's more accountability, and they're in line with maybe what a certain community wants out of a school. So a different method of teaching, a school that might handle dyslexic kids, for instance. All of those are good, I think, uses of a charter-type system. But the problem, and this is across the country, when there was a surge of charter schools and then changes in state laws to allow charter schools, what we found is there are just many businesses that were interested in you know, they saw a lot of money there, they saw a lot of opportunity, and they had state legislatures that wanted to make sure it was easy for them to get that opportunity. So,
but do you think that there was good faith there among the legislature, among the legislators who wanted to allow for this sort of thing? Do you think that they thought, okay, well, this is just a reform that we're trying, and we trust them to do what we're asking them to do?
I think there were definitely legislators that wanted to try different things, and I think we saw that there were cases of public schools that could not handle, for instance, certain areas where the it was very difficult. Kids, very low income, a lot of difficult parts of a student body that for a public school to operate. But of course, many of those have failed because it's a difficult body of students to work with regardless. There might be other ways to do it. But I also believe that it was a kind of a nationwide momentum. Many of this language was written you know, at the national level to allow charters. There was definitely a move to privatize public education because many states have huge budgets. And more than half of our budget goes to education in the state of Indiana. And so there was an opportunity there for private operators, private schools, and that led the push to move from public education to these other private and kind of not-for-profit shell opportunities.
You said in a statement about this that, and I'm quoting here, the Indiana General Assembly failed to take the appropriate measures to prevent something like this from being possible. What specific measures are you talking about?
Well, for instance, with a charter school, there's no need, there's no ability for the state or the Department of Ed to look at their books. So first of all, they gave the charters the ability to hire their own outside auditing company. So these charters are hiring their own accountants to look over their books. And in, for instance, in the case of the virtual school, that auditing company was part of that mix of companies that was getting funds siphoned to them. And these are misappropriated funds. The books were a mess. And I think when you find the only thing, for instance, that the State Board of Account can actually look at is federal title money. So if a charter school is getting money from the federal government, the State Board of Education can actually look just at the federal portion. And what they find is many charters, that even the federal applications are a mess. They're not monitoring the funds correctly. They're not appropriating the funds correctly. So the Department of Education can write, you know, create findings to say, well, this is, you need to do this and that. But I think we all would agree that indication where they're not using federal funds appropriately means that they're probably not managing their own state funds appropriately. But it's not the State Board of Accounts' job to look at that unless they have an indication that there's misappropriation. And really there's no requirement for the charter school to open their books to anybody. And a charter school would, so we have an authorizer. So an authorizer might be Dalesville Schools, for instance.
In this case, yeah.
Right. Then the operator is the virtual school. So they come up with a contract, and the contract stipulates what a authorizer can do in relation to the operator. And when we're talking about a company, for instance, virtual schools pulled in $100 million plus, they have the money to hire the attorneys to create these contracts. You have Dalesville, on the other hand, who's getting a contract and they're looking at, $3 million a year extra into their budget and they're happy. But outside of that, there's no, unless the contract says that the charter school must open their books for periodic reviewing and et cetera, for an independent audit, for example, then they don't have to. Mm-hmm. And I think what happened, actually, Dalesville had to go through the courts to get access to virtual charter schools' books. Now, there's 104 charter schools in the state of Indiana.
Your bill this session, Senate Bill 431, was not heard. What would it have done?
Well, it would have put those guardrails in place. So one is it kind of opens up the requirement that charter schools have to apply. They have to show the State Board of Education that they're actually a valid operating company. They know what they're doing. They have they'll have a system in place to educate kids in whatever method, and also that they can operate financially to get the job done. So there's for one thing, we're having a look at them. That's not the case with the authorizers and the operators under the virtual school or the charter school board. The other thing it would do would be to say that a authorizer has to co-sign any loan that the charter school takes. So out of the common school fund, we've had problems with charter schools borrowing money and not able to pay it back. This would say that the authorizer, so let's pick on Dalesville again, would have to co-sign that loan. All right. So if you're borrowing $20 million, Dalesville is saying we're on the hook for $20 million if this company fails. But it also needs to bond. It would, under my bill, it would have been required that Dalesville would have had to have a bond to protect the state in case of fraud or malfeasance. So all of those things, I think, would have helped, especially in a situation like this. Another thing it does, it says if a charter school is failing, and many charter schools are failing by many metrics, then rather than the authorizer get a cut of the state funding, so the authorizer gets 3%. So in the case of virtual schools, Dalesville would have got roughly $3 million, then they wouldn't have been able to take that money. They would have had to – that money would have stayed with the school, but it would have been directed at improving the school's performance.
Why have attempts like yours to address this not made it through the General Assembly?
Well, I'd like to think that it was just, you know, we're going to assume everybody's doing the right thing, attitude. I think there's also you know, from the perspective of the Republican Party, if the governor's getting $10,000 and $13,000, and if the Republican caucus in the Senate is getting $10,000 and the Republican caucus in the House is getting $10,000 and the chairs of the educational committee are getting $3,000 or $5,000, there's a tendency to want to help that institution who's giving you that money. And I think, you know, that raises a whole other question. What about all these other charters? What have they been donating? And what do they expect out of it? And I think what they expect is less oversight. You know, you let us do what we do. And I'd have to say the reaction hasn't been much different than what you'd expect in that situation. It's more of, well, boys will be boys kind of attitude. We've got it under control. This is an unusual situation. Boy, I hope somebody catches these guys who walked away with $86 million of our taxpayer money siphoned into their bank accounts that didn't educate our kids.
You claim that a lot of charter schools are failing, but do you see value in virtual charter schools like these if they're run well?
To a limited extent. I think they have to be very tightly controlled on, and I think virtual charters can be an aspect of a child's education, but it is hard to imagine. And especially when you look at the results of these virtual charter schools, which are, you know, kids that are down in the low 2-3 percentiles of performance compared to the rest of the kids, or graduation rates that are almost non-existent, 5-7% graduation rates, you'd have to say it's not helping these kids a great deal.
The argument, I guess, for less oversight over more oversight is freedom. And these are kind of new waters that the education system is testing. It seems like a tough balancing act to just see how much of that should be in place. I guess in a lot of ways that it was created to avoid that kind of inflexibility that can come from too much oversight. How do you navigate that, I guess?
Well, I think, I mean, there's, as an example, the House Bill 1003 last year, which was set up to have a look at public schools and their fiscal stability, it wasn't talking about their performance. It was talking about their ability to handle the funds that were going to them. So the Distress Unit Appeals Board can look at all public schools on certain metrics to understand how they're funded, how they're budgeting, how they're managing their books. Simple as that. Charter schools, on the other hand, were excluded from that. And also private schools, so choice schools that received vouchers, were also excluded from that. So it seems to me that we have performance. We understand how their kids are doing. But we also need financial oversight. And that's completely missing. And there's no – I don't know what process many of the Republicans in the legislature are talking about that, oh, this is all under control. It's not under control because – these are private agreements between the operators and the authorizers. They can hire their own private firm to do their books, and then all we get to look at is the results, which say, oh, everything's fine. And it, unless we get the State Board of Accounts to actually do a financial look into these schools, all of these schools, then we're really not going to know what's going on. As far as performance, we can see what their performance is, and it's not high. As a matter of fact, it tends to be much lower than public schools. So we want everybody to have flexibility. I want public schools to have more flexibility. I want our teachers to have more flexibility. There is a bill that's working its way, 1002 this year, that would do that. But I think we do need to make sure that outside of the flexibility to try to teach kids in a different way, we need to make sure that the funds that are coming from Indiana taxpayers are used effectively and efficiently. As I said, you know, over the past 5 years, we've shifted $1.4 billion, big B billion, from our public schools to these different charter school types of operations.
Just about a minute left. Have you spoken to pro-charter groups?
Time flies.
It does. About these issues, have you talked to pro-charter groups about this? Are there disagreements right now about who's to blame and how to address it?
Well, I think charter operators, again, there are good charter operators. I don't want to make a blanket statement, but we need more accountability. We need more oversight and transparency on how they're operated. And also, my feeling is the performance has to improve. So one of the things in my bill is that if you're a charter that's failing, you cannot accept new students. Right now, a charter that's failing can just open up another charter, take more students, or take more students even into a failing charter.
Indiana State Senator Mark Stoops, thanks so much for taking the time to join us.
Thank you.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross and Chris Flood. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can get it wherever you get podcasts. Tomorrow, we'll talk about a South Bend citizen's fight to make food stamps available to ex-drug offenders. In the meantime, we're on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.